Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop craze youngsters, and welcome to the latest episode of Chart Music, the podcast that gets its hands right down the back of the settee on a random episode of Top of the Pops. I'm your host, Al Needham, and with me today are Simon Price.
Hello.
And Sarah B.
Ahoy.
Panel! Like a tramp in the night, I am begging for you to tell me all the pop and interesting things like you want to do.
I went to see our good friends and incredible psychedelic electronic rock troupe Teeth of the Sea.
Ooh.
At our lovely local venue, Walthamstow Trades Hall. I should say, Sam, who plays trumpet for the Teeth, as nobody calls them, is a fully paid up, long term, devoted pop crazed youngster. So,
hey. Oh, bless. That man.
Shout out to you, Sam.
Thank you, sir.
And I successfully did not get COVID for a fourth time.
Yes.
But I did get the consolation prize of a cold for about 6 weeks.
Oh, shitting hell. 6 week cold?
Yeah, that's what you get now. You know, mate. This is like, you know, all of our immune systems are sort of, things are different now, you know.
Oh, man, you want to be like John Travolta in The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, Sarah.
Yeah, I do.
Have you ever seen that film? I was so fucking disappointed by it. It came on the telly after Saturday Night Fever and Grease, and I expected John Travolta to be bouncing around in a big fucking Zorb thing to some disco music or with a quiff on and having a right old time. But no, he was in hospital for fucking ages and it was boring.
That's tedious, isn't it?
Yeah.
For everyone concerned.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we should normalise, actually, now that, you know, people will look askance at you if you have a mask on.
Masks now are like flares in 1981, aren't they?
About as useful and about as stylish, yeah, it's true.
Oh, I don't know, though, because I remember the tail end of COVID and people were starting to go out on buses again. I remember sitting on a bus and these two blokes got on and one of them had a mask on and printed on it, in big white letters on a black mask, was "Will open for cock."
Well,
and I'm sitting there thinking, "Oh, I know this bus route, and I know what time it is. It's when all the old folks clubs start kicking out." So I'm sat there, kind of like on those seats that go along the side of the bus, just waiting for all these old women to come on to get the reactions. And they just looked and just ignored him, or just laughed, or just nudged each other, and it was like, God, that's interesting.
Yeah.
These women didn't give a fuck.
Well, you know, they were young ones too.
Nobody got the cock out to test him at his word.
Well, old grannies now would have been teenagers in the 60s. They've seen it all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Exactly. Yeah.
I feel like everyone has missed a trick with the whole kind of slogans on masks thing.
Mm.
It's a very easy way to say a thing, but you have to be prepared to be saying it after you've forgotten that on your face it says, you know, fuck the Tories or whatever. And, you know, then you go to the Tory party conference and it's really embarrassing. You know. Meanwhile, though, exciting news for the perverse few who want to hear more of me saying things. Our film and television podcast Teledrome rides again imminently.
Oh yes.
This time, John Tatlock and I will be examining a classic of 80s horror cinema and its recent remake. And John will be annoyingly messing about with some sort of puzzle box that he's got. I mean, I have told him that he's going to have to take it out in the edit because it's just this, like, you know, he's really preoccupied with it. You know,
what, like a Rubik's Cube? Or what is it?
I don't know what it is. He's really preoccupied. He hasn't slept in days. He's just kind of sitting cross-legged in an empty room, just like, I'm a bit worried. Anyway, Teledrome, wherever you get your podcast.
I saw John Tatlock the other night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was up in Manchester, had a drink with him, and he didn't have a puzzle box on him then, unless he had it stashed somewhere that, you know, frankly, the sun don't shine. I don't know.
Maybe he solved it.
Oh, no. I think maybe we'd know about it if he'd solved
it. Fair enough. Simon!
If you're happy with a nappy, then you're in for fun. George Michael once taunted Andrew Ridgeley. And,
yes.
And I'm about to find out because we've got a baby on the way.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Well,
the
you know.
The first chart music baby.
Janie has a baby on the way. You know, I had only a small amount to do with it, about 10 cc's worth, you know.
So you're not going to be going around saying, we're pregnant.
Boy or girl?
Girl.
Yeah. Toya. Pee-poo would work for either sex.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, the clans of Price and Burns are about to gain a new generation. I'd assumed I was the end of the family line, you know, and I'd made my peace with that, and I thought I would be seeing out my days in the company of my record collection, just getting pissed on Havana Club all the time. So this is a big life change, especially in my age, but I'm excited for it. So, you know, there's that. Yeah, it's a girl. She's due in February. For the name, we're probably going with a Welsh name, and we do have a front runner, which we're keeping under our hat. The only proviso really is that it has to be pronounced by English people, because she's going to be growing up in Brighton.
Dave, then.
But we don't want to use the front runner name until she's actually born. I don't know if it's superstition or what. So in the meantime, we've gone through this list of Welsh girls' names and picked the ugliest ones we can find, in the knowledge that we're definitely not using them when it's for real.
God.
So names like Grieg, which is spelt Grug,
right?
Or Bithig, which is spelt Budug, or Cranogwen, who sounds like a really angry, hatchet-faced old woman, I think, or Blodeoedd, which is a name for which even I, a Welshman, need to take a bit of a run-up. So we alternate between those when referring to her, in the certainty that she'll not be called that. So, yeah, big changes about to happen around here.
Good Lord.
The other thing, of course, is that my book is finally out there in the world.
Indeed.
Your other baby, yes.
My other baby, yeah. Curepedia, an A to Z of the cure.
Yes.
The reviews have been really positive. I've been travelling around on the sort of promo circuit, met loads of lovely people at spoken word events, book signings. The cure's fan community have been incredibly supportive, and I was kind of quite nervous about that, you know.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have blamed them if they took against it. And it seems to be selling well. It's reached number one in some very niche charts, and you'll know all about this sort of niche charting from chart music, but so for example, biographies of punk musicians, music encyclopedias, because it's an encyclopedia. It fleetingly reached number four in the proper music book charts. It was never going to get any higher with Britney Spears and Barbara Streisand to contend with. My favourite is when it reached number 11 in Amazon's Religious History of Christianity charts.
Fucking hell.
I mean, I suppose there's a chapter on religion and there's a chapter on faith, and the cure are a cult act, so I'll take it.
Maybe they thought it was about the curate.
Oh, of course. Apparently, there's a boring answer to this, and it's that there is another author called Simon Price who does write about religious history, and Amazon's algorithms got it mangled. So, yeah, you know, two births, a book and a baby. And
good Lord.
Ask me in a year's time which one was the hardest, or ask Janie anyway.
A lot more sharp corners on your book.
yeah, I'm going to say that, yeah.
I've actually got a copy of it, Simon. It's fucking gorgeous.
You've done a nice job.
I'm scared to turn the pages of it. I don't feel worthy.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, because it is really nice, it's got this sort of matte texture. It's sort of red with this shiny black silhouette of Robert Smith laid over it, and sort of silver writing. And I do think it's inevitably going to degrade if people carry it around with them. And I'm hoping it'll be like Public Image Limited's metal box, that each copy will become sort of individual in the way that it deteriorates, you know.
Would you mind if I gave my copy away to one of the Polcraze patrons?
Not at all. Why's that? You hate The Cure, basically.
I just think they deserve it more than I. So at some point after this episode has gone out, I will be conducting a random draw, and one of the Polcraze Patreon people will be getting my copy sometime in January. But anyway, I am still reeling from the effects of that beautiful day in September when the Polcraze youngsters assembled for our live show at King's Place for the London Podcast Festival. Fucking hell, it was a proper day, wasn't it, Sarah?
Yes, it was. Yes, it really was.
Massive tar to them, King's Place, and especially the Polcraze youngsters who turned up and said hello to us afterwards and bought us drinks and all sorts. There was actually a couple there who were in their mid-20s. Wow. I couldn't believe it.
Actual Gen Z.
Yes, I got down on my knees in the pub afterwards and genuflected towards them, man. We're reaching that audience, man. We're doing it. We're getting down with the kids.
Yeah, amazing. Literally. Yeah, we are genuflection.
Yes. Yeah, and a special thanks to all the Polcraze youngsters who booked our live stream, which I managed to have a look at afterwards. It was fucking mint. And it gave me the ideal opportunity to see how much I'm turning into Mr. Rumbold as the years roll on. Oh, fucking hell, man. I've got a face for podcasts and a voice for newsprint.
You're being harsh on yourself there.
No, it's all true.
I got away with it this time because I was I was just in the audience, and I got to I got to politely heckle and do a little royal wave, and that was my contribution.
A splendid day, and yeah, I'm starting to get a feel for these live shows now. I'm not so stressed about them. Your turn next, Simon.
That'd be nice,
and it might be sooner than you think. Hit the fucking music. Calling all Polcraze youngsters. You asked for it. We were offered it. So we said, all right then, fuck it, why not? Saturday, January the 13th, 2024. Birmingham Town Hall. Chart Music Live all day. Yes, Polcraze youngsters, Chart Music is getting on down to Benny Tan with the power trio of Simon Price, Neil Kulkarni and Al Needham for a full day of Chart Music ramble. We commence with the return of Here Comes Quizzem, the Chart Music pub quiz. And then, a 3-hour live episode of Chart Music. And then, we round off the evening with a Chart Music disco, where we dance the night away to the white-hot sounds of Joy Sarnie and Two Man Sound. It do be the complete Chart Music experience, Miss Diane, and can be yours for a mere £15. So, see that internet, mash out bit.ly/CM24. That's bit.ly/CM24. Lay your money down and be prepared to be pop crazed all day long in beautiful downtown Birmingham. Hey, piss troll, we're coming for you. Yes, you heard right, Polcraze youngsters. Jesus and Buzz are making themselves available to their public in a few weeks' time. And as you listen to this, I can tell you that I have done precisely fuck all in the way of notes. So I need to get my thumb out my arse and get on with it, because the Polcraze youngsters techno-minginous when it comes to the live shows. If you can't be asked to listen back for that bit.ly link, just go to bmusic.co.uk. That's bmusic.co.uk, and put in a search for Chart Music. The other bit of news is that we've started a new bonus strand exclusively for the Polcraze Patreons called Hit the Fucking Play Button. Ooh. Very simple premise, Polcraze youngsters. We take one music video that was never shown on Top of the Pops, which means that we're never going to be able to talk about it properly on Chart Music, and we pull it to absolute bits. There's two episodes up already, and the third one's already in the bag and will be out in a few weeks' time. And chaps, you've already had a dig at these, and it's been a proper good doss, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Like, if people think that we sort of deep dive Top of the Pops episodes a bit too kind of nerdishly, then just wait till you hear this shit, man.
Oh, oh, voyage to the fucking Earth's core, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good to be able to cover songs that we're never going to do on a regular episode of Chart Music, so... Yeah, it's fucking mint, mate. Cool. The goal is to get one out once a month. So, you know, that's going to be an extra hour or so to mix into your pop craze diet. So if you want all of that, plus the audio of our live show and all the other benefits of being a Pop Craze Patreon, it is time to get some money down this G-string right here and let us shake that arse just for you. And speaking of the Pop Craze Patreons, here is the latest roll call of the lovely people who have put a jingle in our G-string of late. In the $3 section, we have Paul Locker, Lucy Moore, Paul Gavin Chaplin, Mike Davis, Nicole Smith, 72 Heaven, Jonathan Hewitt, Hazel Sidesurf, Nick Reed, Hez, Ray Blake, Titus Cotton, Grassy Knoll, John Broadley, Andy Nyko, Russell Horton, and Dan Dummer. Thank you, babies.
Thank you, lovelies.
I suspect some of those aren't their real names, you know.
And in the $5 section, we have Neve Conroy, Adam Pierce, Stuart, Tim Ward, Petrus Gyra, Michael Avery, Jim Parker, Mayor of Fishguard, Kenny Twat, Russell, James Glover, Kieran Gaynor, Dermot Fitzsimmons, Dr. Craig, James Jimbo Bradley, Chris Kyle, Brian Cairns, Carlos the Jackal, Claire Udi, Aidan DW, Briefly P, Nozza the Knob, Anna Dominoes, Laurie Powell, Andrew Whitehurst, Andy Hall, Mark Smith, and Carl, fucking hell, we love
Bless you.
Come here, give me a fucking hug, you lovely bastards. Oh, Stuart Metcalf and Doug Grant jacked it right up, and so they get a very special arse rub on their trousers this Christmas time. Ooh.
Well done.
Oh, by the way, happy birthday, Aka Shamira, and I'm sorry I missed it. Fuck's sake, man, I'm turning into cunting stewpot nowadays, man. I can't have this. Anyway.
But you got better breath, Al.
Yes. Anyway, as well as all that lovely new bonus content and getting episodes in full without any advert ramble, the Pop Craze Patreons get to tinker in a tanker with the brand new Chart Music Top 10. Shall we?
Yeah.
Shall we?
Go on then.
Hit the fucking music! We've said goodbye to Bjorn Bingerbonger, Toto Coelho Ultras and Ian Interesting, which means four up, two down, one non-mover and three new entries. New entry at number 10, the Quincy Punks. Straight in at number 9, Benefits Cheap Paul Di'Anno. Up one place from number 9 to number 8, the Birmingham Piss Troll.
Yes, yes.
Another one place jump from number 8 to number 7, for here comes Chisholm. But down one place from number 5 to number 6 is Eric Smallshaw of Eccles. Into the top 5, and it's a one place jump from 6 to 5 for Bummer Dog. Down two places from number 2 to number 4, the provisional URURA. Up four places from number 7 to number 3, the bent cunts who aren't fucking real.
Yes.
This week's highest new entry crashes into the chart at number 2, Festival of Sperm, which means
Britain's number 1.
It's still there at the very summit of Mount Pop, Ghost Face Scylla. Oh, What a chart me did. Fucking hell.
All the classics.
Festival of Sperm is going to be really baffling to anybody who isn't listening to hit the fucking play button, isn't it?
Yeah. Shall we tell them, Simon?
Go on.
Explain, Simon, Festival of Sperm.
Well, as I understand it, from my good showbiz friend Martin Degville, it was a working name for Zig Sputnik before they were Zig Sputnik.
So, this week's new entries then, the Quincy Punks. I think pretty obvious what they're all about. You know, they got them skinny ties and shirts tucked into jeans and wacky sunglasses, you know, and capering about in a manner that David disapproves of.
Yeah, it's good Charlotte, basically. Yeah.
Benefits cheap Paul Di'Anno, fairly self-explanatory. But yeah, Festival of Sperm. I hear that name, and what immediately comes to my mind is erotic Morris dancing.
Well, I mean, it is all about fertility rights, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Just bringing it into our century. So I think Festival of Sperm, they're like Enigma, but with a bit less monk chant and a lot more accordion.
Yeah.
And they come out on stage and they clack double-ended dildos together and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's here really comes jism, yeah.
So anyway, Pop Craze youngsters, if you want in on all the excitement that being a Pop Craze Patreon brings into your world, remember, keyboard, patreon.com/chartmusic, money, G-string. So, this episode, Pop Craze Youngsters, takes us all the way back to March the 4th, 1993, which is very much, to my mind, the 90s that nobody really cares about, isn't it? You know, we're post-rave, pre-Britpop, post-optimism, pre-cokey arrogance. The 90s are done. We've got as far away from the 80s as humanly possible, but we don't yet know what the 90s are going to be. So, me dears, if I were to say to you, the music of 1993, what's immediately coming out of those lovely mouths of yours?
Some unholy soup of grunge, Eurodance, and Take That, I think.
I was going to say Peruvian knitwear hat. Oh. Basically, Spin Doctors. If you wanna call me baby, just go ahead now. I've completely fucked all the Pop Craze youngsters' heads now with a mother of all earworms. what that symbolises? Yeah, yeah.
Stop now.
what that symbolises is that grunge and American alternative music, in the broadest sense, had sort of curdled and the dregs were now being scraped from the barrel. But yeah, like you say, Britain hadn't yet stepped up with enough to replace it. You had Suede and the Manics and Saint Etienne and Pulp, but nobody was using the B word yet, of course. But yeah,
I mean, like punk and disco, Britpop was being used in the music papers years before the event.
Sort of with a small B, I guess.
No, because it's British, so it'd be a capital B.
Yeah, I know
what you mean, Sarah. I'm just fucking with you.
I don't know. You had all these sort of tangents that the very best bits of which were enjoyable. So you had funk metal or rap metal that hadn't yet become horrible new metal. So, you know, you had things like Rage Against the Machine. You had kind of, I guess, the aftermath of rave. So bands like The Shaman were massive. And they were kind of irritating but fun at the same time. And G-Funk hadn't quite happened yet, but Cypress Hill were there. And, you know, they were pretty good. And
yes,
you could sort of take a bit of a pick and mix while not thinking that there's any one thing that's completely defining the era yet.
It is a bit of a liminal year, isn't it? I think there's already a certain weariness about it, like everyone's already knackered, you know, even though it's sort of an early mid year in that way. But in terms of the charts, it's like Shat On by Shaggy, Shoveled Up by Blobby. People are tired, the recession's dragging on, and you know, and it is like careful what you wish for, really, because Britpop is coming down the tracks like a runaway train with a single eyebrow. In the full awareness that trains don't actually have eyebrows in general.
Yeah. Well, Thomas the Tank Engine probably has.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, yeah. the eldritch horror of
Liam the Tank Engine. Fucking hell.
Yeah, so rave obviously on its way out very much. The Prodigy's first album only came out last year. They're not considered Britpop, but they're sort of almost on the edge of it because The Fat of the Land a few years later was immense. Mm. There's quite a neat delineation, really, when it comes to dance music. The Castle Morton Common week-long rave happened last year, which some people consider precipitated, almost single-handedly precipitated, the Criminal Justice Bill.
Yeah.
And that starts to mark the beginning of the end of the rave culture that started in 88. Mm. In fact, the Criminal Justice Bill this year was making its way through Parliament with its new rave clause. And the Ministry of Sound...
Repetitive beats and all that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The Ministry of Sound projected their logo onto Parliament, not to protest the bill, but to promote their very first compilation. So that really establishes the corporate evolution of the bootleg rave tape that had been massive up until now. Mm. It was the end of the Free Party era and the start of the Superclub era. So the succession of repetitive beats. Mm. And you could still go mental in a huge crowd of people, but it would cost you at this point.
Mm.
One word that constantly sprung to mind when I was researching this era, malaise. The country's in recession, record sales have dipped for the first time in 12 years, and the music scene is in a state of absolute flux. Baggy's collapsed in on itself, even though the NME is still waiting for the Stone Roses to come back and make everything right again. Factory Records has gone bust, and the youth of Britain are either pretending to be American tramps who have been loaded into a cannon and fired through a branch of millets, or following the clarion call of assorted Ian Beals in hyper-coloured t-shirts who hunch over computers in their bedrooms and make the youngsters take drugs and surrender to machine loops that isn't real music at all. Here's an article I found in The Guardian from the year before, chaps, which kind of lays out the state of music at this time from a certain point of view.
Yeah.
With the soulless machine beat of techno music and its leap from the underground rave scene to mainstream chart success, the science fiction nightmare is in sight. Computers are taking over from creativity, and musicianship is slowly being replaced by the dismal donkey work of the computer programmer. Although not quite the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, music technology may yet undermine a music industry that has traditionally made money out of good playing and songwriting. Techno dispenses with both and is currently the hottest force in the record shops. Bands like Alternate, SL2 and 2 Unlimited sell singles in quantities real musicians dream of by making music so lacking in human qualities that it is difficult to imagine soft flesh ever having anything to do with its creation. In fact, it is all done with drum machines, sequencers and samplers, scavenging among other people's ideas and reveling in banality and repetition. Faceless and personality-free, techno embodies few of the traditional rock inspirations like sex, egomania and sedition. Instead, it is all about money. No musical rebellion has ever started out so mercenary or been so instantly profitable. Given the technology and ability to play a three-fingered chord on a synth, you can bash out a top 10 single ready for pressing in a day. Yeah, you just push a button and On a Ragga Tip comes out. It's AI all over again, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's this kind of conflation and elision that's going on of things that are not the same. So basically, it's written from that point of view that good music has to be music that is handcrafted.
Mm.
Whereas
artisan.
I believe strongly that pop is an entirely user-end art form, that it's all about how you experience it. And if it causes exhilaration or any other emotion in the listener, that's what matters. Mm. I couldn't give a fuck if somebody presses a button and out it pops, or if they've ripped their fingertips to pieces learning how to play the guitar.
Mm.
Good for them if they have. You know, I'm not slagging that off either, but I spent a lot of time in this era arguing with people like this and constant battle, particularly on the Melody Maker letters page. Mm. This could be a bad letter to Backlash, quite honestly.
Yeah, it's a bit like lab-grown diamonds that you get now that are exactly the same as the ones that are mined out of the ground by small children. But, you know, there are people who will still insist that suffering has to happen before you can have beauty. It's like, I don't think that's true.
I mean, when I read this article, it just reminded me so much of the Mither and the Wicklin that's being punted out over AI.
Yeah, but AI is bad, though.
Yeah, well, depends how you use it, isn't it? I mean, there's been interviews with people like Chuck D saying, yeah, there is going to be a lot of shit that's going to come out of it, but there's going to be other people like us back in the 80s and sampling that's going to find a way to make it work and make it sound brilliant and do stuff that you couldn't do before.
You think we're skint now? Sorry.
Yeah, I heard that Chuck D interview and it sort of gave me a bit of optimism. He was saying that in the early days of sampling, a lot of what came out was really unimaginative. It was just one track or one loop over and over and over. But, you know, he said that people like, I guess, the Bomb Squad and Terminator X, and you'd also have to credit Eric B, managed to kind of, well, he used the term to freak it. Chuck D said, we figured out how to freak it. And I think that's basically what's going to happen with AI.
Yeah.
To begin with, it's going to be endless people saying, you know, let's make a Beatles song, not least the Beatles themselves. But, yes. You know, I think and hope we're going to get past that phase and people will figure out a way of making genuinely freaky, amazing music.
I hope so too. I'm slightly more pessimistic. It's like, I thought it was going to make everything else easier for us so that we could be free to make art. And I think it's going to be the other way around.
Yeah, as writers, we were the ones they came for first. But, you know, the thing is, I've spent years of my life researching stuff off the internet and ended up reading other people's shitty writing that was so fucking awful. It might as well have been done by AI.
Yeah, you know,
at least AI wouldn't write without any further ado.
There is a certain kind of uncanny valley effect that you get even when just reading AI-generated prose. And I think, and maybe I'm flattering myself, but I think I can tell the difference. You know, there is something just unsettling and slightly queasy and sickening when you're reading something that wasn't done by a human brain. I think it's possibly already at the stage that it can generate just sort of copy that could sort of describe a washing machine or something like that. But in terms of actual writing about ideas and thoughts, I don't think it's quite there yet. I actually think it's become the lowest form of wit as well, when people just have some idea, what would it look like if Evan Dando went water skiing, and you know, they'll just, and then you'll get a picture of it and it's like, oh, look at this, and it's like, okay. I've got to admit, sometimes it's fooled me. I think I got pranked.
Oh yes,
the other day there was this thing doing the rounds that was meant to be Rick James's house in 1979. Yes. And it looks fucking amazing, kind of sci-fi meets Superfly, this place that he supposedly lived in. I now think it's too good to be true and it's probably AI. The jury's still out on that, I think. But it's just, you know, there's this crestfallen feeling you get of, oh, for fuck's sake, is that all it was?
Yeah.
Well, I want to see these amazing, luxurious rock star palaces from the 70s, but I want to see them for real. I don't want to see...
Yeah, you want the truth.
Yeah, yeah. That surprises me about myself. I never thought of myself as someone who craves authenticity, but maybe my limit has been found and maybe I fucking do. I don't know.
But anyway, going back to the article, you read this kind of stuff, which was not uncommon in the media around about this time, and you start to realise why the corporate whores of the music biz were on their backs with their legs wide open, baying for Shed 7 to show them just how dangerous music can be.
And smelly.
There's this absolute craving for a band or some bands to come along and just take this decade by the scruff of the neck. People want a Beatles, man.
Well, if only a band was going to take the decade by the scruff of the neck in this very episode of Top of the Pops.
If only.
Foreshadow, foreshadow.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Onward!
Radio 1 News.
In the news, a car car bomb has been detonated in the underground car park of the World Trade Center with the intention of crashing the North Tower into the South one and bringing both down. And although both buildings remain intact, 6 people are killed and over 1,000 are injured. The Serbian Liberation Front immediately claimed responsibility, but it turns out to be the work of Ramzi Youssef and his mates in the Liberation Army, a spin-off of Al-Qaeda. 6 people were arrested in a Liverpool court for bricking in a police van containing Robert Thompson and John Venables, while the BBC announced plans to broadcast the funeral of James Bulger live on the BBC One show Good Morning with Anne and Nick.
Christ.
I don't think that happened in the end. Thank fuck. An estimated 15 people are shot dead in a standoff between the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, and it's revealed that 25 of the people still inside are British, some from Nottingham.
Huh?
Have I mentioned this, that David Koresh used to live in St Anne's, near where my granny used to live?
No way.
Yeah, yeah, just about 5 minutes walk from where I'm sitting now. David Koresh lived there in the mid to late 80s.
Hmm.
I know someone, used to be a landlord of the pub I did a pub quiz at, and he was living in St Anne's at the time, and every now and again he'd get a fucking knock on his door. He opened it up, there's fucking David Koresh banging on about Jesus again. It's insane, isn't it?
This is like when Osama bin Laden was standing on the clock end at Highbury. It's one of those things that doesn't seem
yes,
to...
I know.
It's like it's been generated by AI or something.
Tony Bland becomes the 96th victim of the Hillsborough disaster. Justice for them.
Yeah.
The US Air Force have started to airlift relief supplies into Bosnia for the benefit of Muslim refugees, including ration packs which contain pork.
Christ.
No special consideration has been made for that, said a USAF spokesperson, but it is easy to recognise and they can always throw it away. Cast members of Coronation Street are threatening to quit the soap for good if Granada TV end up selling the broadcast rights to Be Sky B. Granada, who claims that the programme generates over £100 million a year in advertising revenue for the ITV network, wants to double their price from £40,000 to £80,000 per episode. And if they can't get that from ITV, they're threatening to take it to Murdoch. Members of the cast are famous for their charity work and caring attitude to the less fortunate, said a Granada insider. Most of them are desperately concerned about the effect a possible sale could have on pensioners and other lonely people. They regard street characters as their friends and can't afford a satellite dish. Fucking hell, that would be the end of the world if Coronation Street moved to satellite.
Mm.
Tory rent-a-gob Jeffrey Dickens has blasted ITV for screening an HIV-positive vicar kissing his dying boyfriend on a documentary this very evening. What are children to make of all this, he said. It will encourage some of them to dabble in homosexual activities, he said of the documentary series 3D. Vicars should act responsibly in public. If you can't trust your vicar, who can you trust? Gotta say, if I was 14 and I saw a vicar snogging another man, I'd think very seriously about having a dabble. John Hendry of E17, currently at number 10 in the charts with Deep, and his mate have been attacked by 5 thugs with iron bars in Walthamstow after the latter chattered up one of their girlfriends. After going to hospital to have 12 stitches in his head, he said, I can't understand why people do things like that. If they think they're being real men, they're very much mistaken. Bruce Dickinson has announced that he's leaving Iron Maiden, but will stay on until August to do a farewell tour and wring a live LP out of it. But the big news this week is that the IRA have targeted Mr. Blobber. After leaving a bomb in a bin outside Athena in Camden, which injured 14 people, a threat of another bomb at Television Centre was issued, forcing the BBC to cancel its live episode of Noel's House Party and replace it with a repeat of the 1992 version of Noel's Christmas Presents and a repeat of the greatest episode of Tom and Jerry ever, Zoot Cat, where Tom falls for a bobby soxer and makes his own zoot suit out of a deck chair and a lampshade, only to be comprehensively cocked blog by Jerry, who ends up dancing with her and presumably having a relationship. Fucking hell, what a cunt of a mouse Jerry was.
Yeah, what a little fucker.
And the IRA there, not just there for the nasty things in life. So getting rid of Noel Edmonds for an evening, sort of.
To be fair, the IRA only threatened to kill somebody on Noel Edmonds' primetime TV show. Noel succeeded.
Yes. You know, so. What a fucking grim time 1993 is. Jesus.
Yeah. There was just this sense of what's the fucking point. I mean, the Tories had won the election the previous year. You know, there was this flurry of optimism that Kinnock was going to get in. A flurry to which, sadly, Kinnock himself was only too prone. Well, all right! Yeah. All right! Yes. All that.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, when that failed, it was like, oh God, we got another 5 years of the fucking Tories.
Yeah.
It's not surprising that a lot of people just sort of turned inwards and just couldn't face politics anymore for a while.
On the cover of Melody Maker this week, Pearl Jam. On the cover of Smash Hits, E17. The number one LP in the country at the moment is Diva by Annie Lennox. And over in America, the number one single is A Whole New World by Peebo Bryson and Regina Bell. And the number one LP is the soundtrack to The Bodyguard by Whitney Houston. So, me dears, what were we doing in April of 1993?
I was just about to turn 15. Ooh. Things were not going to improve significantly from being 14. It sucked. I survived, like you do. It was a hideous roiling cauldron of being bad at netball and hockey.
Oh, Sarah. That's the chart music netball team gone for an absolute toss.
It was the knickers, though. The gym knickers, the navy gym knickers that were the ultimate humiliation, although not as uncomfortable as the socks.
Really?
Yeah, like the navy kind of like knee socks that you had to wear. And they were so scratchy. Like, I don't really understand why it had to be this way. There's loads of ways to exercise. Why did it have to all be about, you know, the kind of social death of competitive sport? It sucked.
While wearing knickers, was Sepp Blatter in charge of this? Do you remember he said that women's football would be more popular if they all just played wearing knickers or something? I mean, Jesus.
Tied to shorts. God. That were practically knickers.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's be honest.
Well, we did have little, you know, sort of little tiny skirts. We were allowed to, you know, to preserve what remained of our dignity. But, you know, yeah. And it always rained.
Oh.
This is the thing. It's like it was always, especially when it was hockey. So you were just like up to your neck in filth and humiliation. But other than that, everything was great.
I played hockey at one school that I went to. It was fucking terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably the scariest sport I've ever played. Jesus.
We played at our school every now and again. Yeah. Let's give all the fucking head cases in the school a big wooden stick to wave about. That's a great idea.
And when you see what the goalkeepers have to wear, these massive fucking samurai outfits with all the padding.
They're absolutely fucking funked.
Yeah, and you realise that's there for a reason. There's a reason why you have to, like, have all that crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Never again.
Music wise, Sarah, what are you into?
Well, here's the thing. So I had a little bit of a personal revelation at the recent triumphant Chart Music live show. Having been on this podcast for 7 years now, as we all have. 7 years?
I know.
And having, you know, done the hey, what were you listening to at this time thing, and racking my brains and just going, oh, yeah, I am actually the chart music girl of the intro. Because you don't get the full effect from the audio. You need to see her face and Chris Needham's face.
When we do a live show, we open it up with a clip of the opening bit of audio where Chris Needham says, so what kind of music are you into?
Yeah.
The girl says, chart music.
Yeah.
And you always get this gasp of recognition when that comes on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is wonderful. And I don't want to, you know, she clearly a person in her own right, and I hope she's doing great. But, you know, she isn't the one, there is a giggle, which is actually her friend who is a little bit embarrassed, like, oh, you've been put on the spot. And she doesn't actually, she looks like she's taking the question seriously, and then kind of finds it tiresome that she's even been asked, and says, chart music. Like, why are you even asking? What do you think I'm into?
And she's the most attractive girl sat on that bench as well. Chris has obviously gone for her first.
Yes.
See, he asks this other girl what they think of heavy metal music.
Yes.
This girl goes, oh, say it's brilliant, Nicole. And she goes, it's brilliant! Really taking the piss.
It's such a teenage thing. Like, you know, as soon as you're asked anything by someone, you know, who's older than you, and it's like, oh, you've got to make sure you say the right thing. And the chart music girl doesn't actually care to say the right thing. So I take inspiration from her.
Hang on a minute. If you're the chart music girl, that means all the rest of us are Chris Needham.
I'm afraid it does.
Well, can we deny it? Yeah.
Strutting up to you with our musical knowledge hoisted over our shoulder and banging against our head. That's a bit scary.
So I was grudgingly appreciative of Take That. Right. My best friend was a huge fan.
Who was her favourite?
Jason.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Jason Orange. Mm. I think she chose well. I think that has, but history has proven her right on that one.
Wasn't he the nearest one that was in Take That to a bad boy before Robbie started acting the cunt?
I don't know. Does Howard count as the bad boy now? Or just the wrong boy. Yeah. Jason was just ever so nice, and she met him, and he was just absolutely lovely. So, you know. But you know that, as I'm sure I have related, probably more than once, they played at my school.
Yes.
I always have to mention that. That was quite surreal and brilliant. And I thought Prey was a banger. Mm. So, you know, and I stand by that. I was very into, predictably enough, Janet Jackson's latest self-titled album, the one with the man bra on the cover. I like to think that she just went around that entire year with her undone jeans, topless, with the man walking around behind her just covering her boobs and just giving them a little uplift.
That's a job you don't see advertised down the job centre, isn't it?
Yeah. No.
Well, you know, AI is going to just take care of that in the future.
Yeah. For everyone, I hope. I'd like a robot cupping my breasts as I was going about my business.
But yeah, That's the Way Love Goes, which was the sort of massive single of that. It's the, still the smoothest substance to ever enter the human ear and sort of into all of its cockles, you know. And Duran Duran put out their self-titled album. Ordinary World is the one Duran Duran song that even people who hate Duran Duran understand to be great.
Yeah.
But this is definitely, this is one of those years for me where 90% of the music will give me just an overpowering pang because it's all steeped in the kind of histrionic moonshine of the adolescent experience. Mm. You know, any spark of anything from D-Ream on down will just make my memory go...
Simon.
I was 25 and I was writing for Melody Maker. I was a bit of a rising star by this point, I suppose, quite well established.
Yeah.
I was doing a lot of reviews and features, and also I was running the arts and media section, which was called Preview, where I would write about films, comics, TV, games, anything that wasn't music, basically, which was quite good for freebies.
Mm, I'll say.
I remember getting a suede waistcoat to promote Clint Eastwood's The Unforgiven.
Right.
And a coffin shaped box set of Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. So that then became Simon Price's Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula when I owned it.
This Clint Eastwood waistcoat,
What
did it have on it? Because, you know, you do get freebies, but more often than not, they're plastered with a logo of something that's going to go massively out of date in a month or two.
Yeah, I mean, it did have the words The Unforgiven embroidered on the breast pocket. I could wear it underneath a jacket, but yeah, it's basically completely useless.
And that's what pins are for.
Yeah, I suppose it's what badges are for, patches or something. I should have thought about that, but yeah. I was in a bedsit on the top floor of a side street in Tufnell Park / Holloway, which was so tiny, I could reach everything I owned from my bed, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Mr. Tickle.
No, I didn't even need to be Mr. Tickle. I could be a Tyrannosaurus Rex with tiny little arms. This included the rickety Leaning Tower of Pisa like wooden habitat shelves with my records on, the Allen screws always threatening to give way and cause a vinyl avalanche. Yeah, I'm sure you remember that. Before IKEA was on the scene, you know, this is what you had to make do with.
You had to go to MFI.
Yeah. Jesus. The Plaster of Paris skulls and magical incense burners, which I bought from Mysteries of Covent Garden when I was going through an embarrassingly late in life occultist phase.
No.
I cringe when I think back on that.
Did you have tarot cards?
All that. Yes, I did, Al. I had all that shit. I'm really embarrassed. I was 25, man. It's too late in life to be doing that.
Shameful.
I pride myself on being very rational, you know.
Yeah, there were loads of people I knew around about this time who went through a tarot phase because they were all fucking hippies. But I had one mate who I'm not going to name here, and he claimed to be able to read futures with just a pack of playing cards. What he had to do, first of all, though, was take a reading of your aura before he touched the pack and did a reading. And luckily for someone like me, it was dead easy. All he had to do was put his palm like millimetres away from mine. But for some reason, and you're not going to believe this, that never worked with women's palms. So he had to do a full body aura reading for them.
Fuck's sake.
And yeah, right. I've seen him do that. And yeah, it was the most shameful thing I've seen in my life. And it never worked. Shame on you. You know who you are.
I once played a game of poker with tarot cards. I got a full house. Everyone died. That's a Stephen Wright joke.
I can do a pretty good Stephen Wright. Hang on. I once played a game of poker with tarot cards. I got a full house. Everyone died.
Yes.
So anyway, there you were, Simon, dancing, laughing, drinking and loving in Bedsit Land.
There was all that occultist stuff. I had the Macintosh computer that I spoke about in another episode, which used to belong to Michael Grade, and on which I got so obsessed with playing Lemmings that I'd often stay in and finish a game rather than go out and have a life and go to gigs and parties and stuff,
mate,
that I'd been invited to. So I'd just sit in there, like, you know, later at night, oh no. That's good.
When you take your eye off the ball and then you'd realise that somewhere
they're all falling off the edge,
there's
yeah.
a cliff that you're like, oh no, that's a very stressful game.
Oh god, you've been there too. And the building in which I was living was mildly infested with what I can only describe as brown fish.
What?
They looked like silverfish, but they were actually brown.
Ugh.
I think they were cockroaches.
No, they had that sort of tapered shape. They were small, and they were basically silverfish, but brown ones. And
maybe they were really old silverfish that had, like, got tarnished.
Well, it should be the other way round, that like they start off brown and then go silver with age, as we do. I don't know, yeah. But it was pretty horrible, and it was all I could afford at the time. I remember inviting Luke Haynes from the Auteurs there so I could interview him, and I was embarrassed that a pop star, even a fairly minor one, was getting to see exactly how poorly paid we music journalists were. Mm. I had a small number of extravagances that I could treat myself to, that I could afford, right? When I wanted a taxi, I had the number of this chauffeur, or chauffeurs, I suppose I should say, because she was a lady limousine driver, wearing a uniform and a cap.
No.
Yes, and she would pick me up and ferry me around town for only slightly more than a cab fare.
Wow.
Because I think most of her chauffing work was done in the daytime. And right. from her point of view, she might as well make a few extra quid in the evenings, I suppose. Mm. And from my point of view, I think she only lived around the corner. So I knew that if I couldn't get a taxi, it was, you know, that there it was. And I would turn up in style in a fancy car.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
Like an inverted Lady Penelope and Parker.
Yeah. And I didn't even do that thing that the Pink Panther did of, you know, give her a coin, but it's on a piece of string and sort of whip it back. You know? I'd also bought myself a proper leather biker jacket, and I'd painted the Sheep on Drugs logo on the back, right? Because Sheep on Drugs were fucking awesome, and I didn't want to have one of the three most common goth insignia on my jacket, which were Sisters of Mercy, Bauhaus, or Einstürzende Neubauten. Okay. So Sheep on Drugs it was, even though doing the detail, if you can imagine this, doing the detail on the syringe with a fine brush with acrylic paint really wasn't easy, but just about got
you
away
did it
with
yourself.
It Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'd be did terrified to do that, man.
Yeah, yeah, on a fucking quite expensive jacket.
Even if it was just a fucking Jam logo.
Yeah, yeah, I did it. I got away with it. Got away with it. The other extravagance was my hair. Mm. All men can identify with this. Something happens around the age of 23 where men start nervously glancing up at each other's hairlines. Like, is he going or is he just me? Yeah. Well,
is he or isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I was going. Which seemed exceptionally cruel, but not unexpected when I looked at the male members of my family. But I managed to long it out for a bit longer by throwing money at it.
Right.
Not by wearing a wig, but getting extensions, right? I went to this this quite famous alternative hair salon in Kensington called Antenna, and they gave me this massive mane of synthetic dreadlocks, which I wore with an Axl Rose-style bandana.
And Hulk Hogan. slogan.
Yeah, right, yeah. A white man in dreads might be accused of cultural appropriation, but that wasn't what I was aiming for. My vibe was more this kind of hybrid glam rock, industrial, cyberpunk kind of vibe I was going for.
He was losing his hair.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, but I got to say, he looked cool as fuck. So basically, yeah, living in a shitty bedsit, but leather jacket, limousine, nice hair. That was it.
That must have left amazing marks on your face. You slept on your side, you know.
Yeah, well, also...
You just have amazing cheek tattoos in the morning. Mm.
I put these little metal beads in the dreads as well. So if I was at a nightclub swishing them about, they would whip me in the face with quite some force.
Like Bob Marley.
Yeah, and I sort of rattle when I'm walking down the streets. It's like a sort of abacus. If I didn't place the beads in just the right place, yeah, it would be quite noisy.
No, you were right to do all that kind of shit. One of the biggest regrets of my life was I didn't do more magic shit with my hair.
Well, that's it, you know.
And you know, if there are any youngsters listening to this, any actual youngsters, I know it's a long shot, but if you are in your 20s, just do all the maddest shit with your hair that you can.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. I just took one look at my dad when I was about 16 and I thought, fuck this, if that's my future, I'm gonna have every mad hairstyle I can have. So I did. Yeah. I continued.
That extends to a lot of other things about your appearance. It's like the Nora Ephron quote about, like, if I had known, when I look back at the pictures of me in my 20s, and if I'd only known, I would just have worn a bikini the entire time.
Well, I'm living in a tiny flat on the top floor in Isle with me and my girlfriend, just across the road from the gym that Lady Di used to go to first thing in the morning.
Right.
Yeah, you know the one where the owner ended up taking secret gusset shots of her a few months later?
Right.
And it was all over the papers, yeah. I never saw her. She could have always come in for a cup of tea or something. Well, not tea, I didn't drink it. She could have a black coffee. I'm in the final months of university and by this time absolutely gagging to get the fuck out of it and plunge into the real world. I've already decided what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a magazine writer and I don't give a fuck what magazine it's going
to
be.
So in order to see your future, you peered in through a drinking straw into a cup of Coke and it's got porn in it.
Yes! Hey, communicating through porn.
A drinking straw in the shape of a cock.
Yes. Music-wise, well, I'm in a proper relationship for the first time ever, so you can't really nestle with your paramour to Back the Fuck Up by Onyx or Gangsta Bitch by Apache, so I've stepped away from hip-hop a little bit.
Right.
And I'm also really skinned. I'm working a side job at Richmond Odeon, selling popcorn and fucking fizzy drinks to cunts.
Mm.
And I'm spending less money on records, more on my girlfriend, and I'm digging back into my collection of Isaac Hayes, Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye.
Mm.
I played this Archie Bell and the Drells album a lot round about this time. Going back to my roots, if you will. I'm still keeping abreast of the new stuff, you know. I'm listening to the local pirate station, Don FM, and getting into Jungle.
Mm.
And I'm religiously taping Westwood on Capital Radio every Friday. That was a lifeline to me.
Yeah. I know we all find Westwood more than just a ridiculous figure nowadays, but a toxic figure. But did you find him hilarious at the time?
Oh, God, yeah. X amount of hilariousness, as the man himself would say.
Yeah, baby boy!
I'm not a play hater, not a play hater.
That all the time, yeah.
In this country, he was the gatekeeper, because where else in 1993 could you turn on a radio at a certain time and be guaranteed a chance to hear, I don't know, the latest LP by Brand Nubian months before you could get it in the shops, or, you know, like later on in the year, the Wu-Tang Clan. First time I heard them was on Westwood. Wasn't going to hear them anywhere else. So, you know, that's how it is. You know, you, as a pop-crazed youngster, I was used to the idea that in order to listen to some fucking amazing music, I had to sit through a twat talking about it beforehand. So, you know, Dave Lee Travis then, Tim Westwood now.
Yeah.
Anyway, chaps, I do believe it is time to retire to the chart music crap room, riffle through a box or two, and pull out an example of the music press from this very week. And this time, I'm going for the NME.
Boo.
March the 6th, 1993. Shall we leave?
Boo hiss, yeah. Let it go, Simon.
On the cover, Mark Gardner of Ride and Tim Burgess of The Charlatans, the chip pan-headed cherubs of student indie, holding sticks of rock in their mouths as if they were cigars. In the news, well, The main story this week is the post-mortem on the death of the Happy Mondays. According to the NME, Sean Ryder has begged the rest of the group to reconsider their decision to split up following the collapse of their $1.7 million deal with EMI. We had a meeting and there was only one man who wanted the band to stay together. Sean, claims an unnamed Monday. He apologised for his behaviour, but certain band members said, no, we've had enough. Further details of the band's disintegration has emerged, which began 3 weeks ago when Ryder walked out of a band meeting with EMI A&R director Clive Black before the deal was signed, claiming he was going out for a Kentucky Fried Chicken, band code for custard ganitre, and never returning. When Ryder failed to convince Black in a subsequent phone conversation that he was a reliable investment, the deal was pulled, resulting in band manager Nathan McGough issuing P45 sworn band members and quitting the next day. According to local rumours, Ryder has already smashed up the Monday's office and is currently scouring the city for McGough, brandishing a hunting knife. Meanwhile, the rest of the band remained unmoved by appeals from Sean to reconsider. Most of the band have wives, girlfriends, families and mortgages, said the source. The EMI deal offered financial stability and Sean has just taken all of that away.
It's quite sweet imagining the Happy Mondays being bothered about mortgages and stuff like that. Mm. You know, they're obviously 12-hour party people, really.
Meanwhile, Ryder's found time to attend court, where he's fined £650 and banned from driving for 18 months over drink drive charges relating to a car crash with a vicar in a larder last July.
A vicar in a larder. Mm.
Yeah, I wonder if he was snogging his boyfriend at the time. He claimed that he has absolutely no disposable income and asked to pay the fine in instalments before leaving with Oriole Leach, the daughter of former Monday's collaborator Donovan, after the court revealed that he has left his wife Trish and their baby. Oh, man, yeah. Grim times to be Sean Ryder.
He says absolutely no disposable income, but is that just because he has disposed his income? Very regularly, yes. Into the hands of the local drug lord.
Yeah, he's liquidised his assets.
He's powderised his assets, probably, yeah.
Meanwhile, Apache Indian has had a fun evening at the Kudos nightclub in Watford, which culminated with him taken to the stage with several minders in order to explain to the 2,000-strong audience that he had not been booked to appear at the venue that night, contrary to posters slapped up all around Hertfordshire. Following the inevitable altercation with venue security, a female steward was allegedly struck in the stomach, and a photographer claims that he was biffed by Apache's henchman and required 10 stitches to a head wound. Apache completely denies the allegations, which are considered to be malicious distortions of the truth, claimed a spokesperson for the arranged marriage hitmaker.
Fucking hell.
Great news for all yous who like to jiggle that joypad. You too are working with computer game giant Sega to produce an interactive Zoo TV CD, revealed the NME. You're going to be able to mix your own videos to our songs. There will be a colour box, if you like, of images, and you're going to be able to remix our music for yourself, said Bono the Hedgehog. Sadly, the deal falls through, but when the Mega CD add-on for the Mega Drive hits the UK next month, you'll be able to spend upwards of £40 on the Make My Video series, where you can remake the videos of INXS, Criss Cross, CNC Music Factory, and Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch.
Now, what really happened was you buy a Mega Drive and it had the U2 game preloaded onto it, whether you liked it or not.
Jim Rose, the hippie punk circus leader, is well dischuffed that his current UK tour is in disarray after RSPCA protests and concerned local councils have cancelled his shows in Bristol, Portsmouth and Edinburgh. The whole thing is insane. No one here seems to be getting the feel and message of the show. Everything is done with real humour, he says. The RSPCA's complaints about slug eating are ironic, given that snails and oysters are a delicacy. And his mate, Matt the Tube Crowley, defended his bile bear act, where he swallows a 7-foot tube, pumps a sort of fluids into it, pumps them out again, and invites members of the audience to have a sip, claiming that he's constantly tested for HIV, syphilis and hepatitis, and he always cancels his act when he has a cold or flu.
Fucking hell, did you go and see them?
No.
I did.
Right.
It was at Clapham Grand. They were always turning up at festivals, though, but they had their own show at Clapham Grand. Mm. I mean, I saw that stuff you just described going on, that the guy regurgitating his stomach flu. I did not drink any of it myself.
No.
But the highlight of the show was Mr. Lifto. Do you know about Mr. Lifto?
Yes.
So, for those who don't know what this guy would do, he would put a fucking hook, like a butcher's hook, through his foreskin, and then he would lift fucking breeze blocks from, you know, with his cock. It was quite remarkable.
Mm.
They turned up in the X-Files as well.
Yes, it did, yeah.
I guess it was based on Todd Browning's Freaks, that kind of travelling freak show. Mm. And it was them. It was the Jim Rose Circus.
Yeah, by the way, in case anyone is thinking about eating slugs, or maybe, you know, as a sort of a food hack to have a nice sort of French cuisine, just don't. Just absolutely don't. It's amazing that we got away with, you know, it's a global pandemic. Yeah, it's incredible we got away with it for so long when there were people shenanigans like this happening for entertainment.
Vince Power of the Mean Fiddler Group, who used to book acts for the Reading Festival until it wound down last year, has announced the inaugural Phoenix Festival, which will be held at the Long Marsden Airfield near Stratford-upon-Avon in mid-July. Sonic Youth, Faith No More and the Black Crows have already been confirmed as headliners, and the bill would end up taking in the likes of Julian Cope, House of Pain, Pop Will Eat Itself, the Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopressa, the Young Gods, Living Colour, the Manic Street Preachers, Hole, Pulp, Gil Scott-Heron, Gangstar with Roy Ayers and Donald Byrd, and Sheep on Drugs.
Hey.
All spread across four stages, and all for £49 plus 50p booking per person. Did you partake, Simon?
Yeah, I did. It was a weird one, Phoenix. It's a sort of festival that didn't know what it was. It was very eclectic to a fault, almost. You know, there were just so many different stages of, you know, there'd be a jazz stage and a hip-hop stage and a techno stage and all this kind of stuff. I guess it was a bit like Glastonbury in that sense, but without any kind of countercultural or any kind of cultural vibe to it. It was just, here's all the music that's around, sort of divvied up into little pockets, and you can sort of wander around it. But they got some massive headliners.
Pick and mix.
Yeah, but it didn't really know what it was, and I can see why it didn't last, but I liked it because, you know, it was on an airfield, so it was a flat surface, plenty of concrete, and there were hotels nearby, because I hate camping. But they managed, I guess, you know, basically the Mean Fiddler Group had that kind of clout, but they managed to get some massive headliners. They had David Bowie, Bob Dylan on headlining, but also, you know, they also had people like Suede and Bjork, who are more of that era. So I think it was a really underrated festival. Yeah, I miss it.
What were the toilets like?
They were all right, you know. Some of the things that happened at, I mean, I was mostly backstage, so I probably would have had the luxury toilets. But some things I remember happening there were, I had a pint of what I hope was water poured over my head by one of Pop Will Eat Itself.
Right.
I went in goal for a penalty.
Probably wasn't water then.
Exactly, yeah.
Rust your dread beads?
Yeah, probably. I went in goal in a penalty shootout against the Cardigans, or between the Cardigans.
Right.
And Nina Persson scored a goal past me. Possibly I was a little bit distracted by the fact that it was Nina Persson. And my friend, Emmy Kate Montrose from Kinnicky, did the most amazing thing. She wasn't looking where she was going, and she bumped into Coolio and knocked him flat on his ass.
No, man.
if nothing else, Phoenix Festival gave me that memory.
Over in Stateside, USA, the NME reveals that Prince's much-publicised meeting with Morrissey, planned to coincide with last week's Grammys, has been postponed after the latter decided not to attend the ceremony. The NME reports that a spokesman says Mozza is recovering from a bout of flu, but plans to reschedule the chin wag.
8 years earlier, that would have blown my mind, you know, eight years earlier, the idea of Prince meeting Morrissey. But what are they going to talk about?
No, God.
What the fuck? You know, I like singing about sex. Oh, well, I don't. All right, bye then.
Yeah.
God, it'd be like that Guardian thing dining across the divide, wouldn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. And finally, Salt and Pepper have warned the public that a fake Pepper is currently at large in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and is currently trying to obtain a record deal using the rapper's real name, Sandy Denton. So, if you encounter a woman with massive gold trunk earrings on your doorstep and she attempts to encourage you to push it real good, contact the police immediately. In the interview section, well, Northern Irish Noise Nick's therapy sit down with Keith Cameron in Brussels and immediately start banging on about how thick their fan base are. Fans listen to the likes of Teeth Grinder and say, oh, if only they'd made it a little bit heavier, it would be the same sort of thing as Nine Inch Nails. It's not meant to be that in the first place, moans frontman Andy Cairns. One thing that always disappoints me is that I tend to grant our fans with enough intelligence to realise what we're trying to do. Certain people we used to work with always get digs in now. There's a lot of people with the mentality that your music's got shite because you're on a major. If people think our music has got shite and they genuinely think that, fair enough. But it's nothing to do with being on a major. Punk's got into the hands of the middle classes now. When I saw Huggy Bear for the first time, I thought they were great. But when you start ramming your manifestos down people's throats, it's lost any of the vibrancy that the original punk had. There's a fine line between Huggy Bear, Corner Shop and Bono. Whether you're preaching to the Camden Falcon or to Madison Square Garden, there's not much difference. I feel like Pete Townsend when punk came along.
Sarah, you were the sort of right age to be supposedly the target audience for Riot Girl. Did it actually reach you at the time?
Or, no, it didn't actually. Not in the wilds of West Yorkshire on the windswept hockey field. No, it didn't actually. Not at all.
And that's exactly the problem with it for me. The very people that it should have been targeting, it didn't, because it was a closed elitist world of people on college campuses, university campuses, who could afford to print up, you know, limited run vinyl singles or fanzines and stuff. I agreed with a lot of the sentiments of what they were doing, but it used to drive me insane that people thought, well, that's feminism sorted then. That's fine, you know. Yeah, because, you know, that's done now. No, it fucking isn't.
Oh, by the way, therapy with a question mark in the end. Do you say their name like you were Australian?
With Uptalk Therapy?
The question mark at the end was because of Letraset. They had, they were sending out demo tapes and they kind of got the spacing wrong between the letters and there was a big gap at the end.
Oh.
So they just thought, fuck it, put a question mark on the end to make it look better. They were all right, Therapy. I went away with them to Las Vegas around this time for Melody Maker. And I remember going back to the kind of image I had at the time with the massive dreadlocks and the leather jacket. You can imagine that the climate in Nevada wasn't necessarily ideal for and I was wearing shitloads of makeup as well.
Oh, Simon.
So Tom Sheehan, the photographer, took us all out to the Sierra Nevada desert to do a photo shoot, you know, and it's proper American desert. You can hear snakes rattling and all that kind of stuff. And everyone else is sort of wearing sensibly sort of shorts, short sleeve shirts, stuff like that. I'm there, big army boots, black leggings, black knitted sort of crocheted long jumper underneath my black leather jacket with all the makeup and a black headband, big black dreadlocks. And I refused to compromise my look for the weather. I thought, fuck you, weather.
Oh, Simon.
You were the original goth in hot weather, weren't you, Simon?
Yeah. I was. I fucking was. My favourite memory of that trip, though, was that evening we all went to some kind of cocktail bar on the Strip in Vegas, and there was an Elvis impersonator.
Right.
And
of course,
for those who don't know, Tom Sheehan is a Cockney gentleman who speaks in Cockney rhyming
slang.
Yes. Right. A lot of it, it's not the standard rhyming slang. He often makes up his own.
It's bespoke. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was this Elvis impersonator with the full kind of jumpsuit and massive flares. And Tom turns to us and says, look at the callards on that cunt. And we're like, what, callards? And he goes,
oh yeah, I've got it.
Callard and Bowsers, yes. Trousers.
Yeah, I remember the classic Tom Sheehan-ism was Fucking hell, someone spilt beer on, they spilt it on my hinge.
Right.
Hinge and bracket. Packet. Jacket.
Oh, jacket. Yeah. Oh, okay. I thought it was packet.
Yeah. I don't think I would have pronounced the question mark. I think the question mark is silent in therapy. Mm. They were really good fun. I saw them like some years later when I think they got back together at the Electric Ballroom. And it was really great and very loud. And Andy Cairns led the crowd in a chant of "You Fat Bastard," which was...
Have you ever shagged on acid? Your cunt feels this big, says Leslie Rankin of Silverfish to Sean Patton before she can even get the top off her biro.
Not Brownfish.
Not Brownfish. Brownfish sounds like a name that the spin doctors rejected. You know, it was in like the before they adopted that. You know, it was in the shortlist.
Yeah, or the name of their roder.
Oh God! And now I'm remembering the League of Gentlemen film where Tubbs has a shit and says, "I've made a little fish, a little brown fish."
After letting that hang in the air, she proceeds to coat down the big thing du jour. Riot Girl is all a load of bollocks. I'm sick to death of hearing about it. It's not interesting. I feel no affinity with it at all. I don't need a movement to express my opinions. There are plenty of women around who don't have to be part of something, and I don't give a fuck how people see me. I'm not people-hating, but I'm not keen on them. Why? They're thick as a shithouse door, most of them.
Silverfish were great, But I can see why they wouldn't be having any of that Riot Girl stuff.
Awkwardly, the enemy have devoted 4 pages to a Riot Girl special. Is it Riot Girl or Riot Girl?
Go for it, Al. Stretch it out.
Okay. Awkwardly, the enemy have devoted 4 pages to a Riot Girl special. Liz Evans spends the first 2 pages breaking down the history of the movement and interviews Lush and Kim Gordon, while Huggy Bear knock out a 2-page manifesto with help from Stephen Wells, because, hey, you can't entrust this sort of thing to just women. Who do we want to reach? Asked Joe Johnson. We want to reach those brilliant punk rock women who've been worrying about what men think about them and are now cool and sassy fucking punk rock women. But if they're alone and isolated, then they're going to end up like my mother. We've got to make contact. This generation seems to have been convinced that it can't do anything for itself, that it's all been done before. Huggy Bear see all around them the indie whores, right swells, tedious transit van bands who don't want to change their t-shirts, never mind the world, all of them gagging to be interviewed by white, male, middle-class, boring rock hacks for a white, male, middle-class, boring readership. This, in case you were wondering, is not an interview. It's an article written with the band's cooperation. My fee for the article will be donated to the King's Cross Women's Refuge.
Bless him.
In the centre spread, there's a most unsavoury image of Tim Burgess of the Charlatans and Ride's Mark Gardner, who are about to embark on a joint headliner tour, sucking on opposite ends of a stick of rock like the dogs in Lady and the Tramp.
Can I stop you there? I was really fucked off about this.
Right.
Because this was my idea.
What?
Yeah, because the whole thing of the Charlatans and Ride going on tour, the news of that reached us at Melody Maker with plenty of notice. And when we were having an editorial meeting, I said, well, it's obvious. You've got to get Tim Burgess and Mark Gardner together on the front of Melody Maker, sucking on opposite ends of a stick of rock. Because they were both beautiful boys with luscious lips, and, you know, it would have looked perfect. It couldn't just be a pink stick of rock. It would have to be one with sort of spiral swirling patterns around it so that you can see what it is that they're sucking on. And people just looked at me and said, no. And I said, well, if you don't do it, NME will. Basically like Alan Partridge, where he's on, you know, Partridge is going on about monkey tennis and inner city sumo, you know, presented by Chaz and Dave or whatever. If you don't do it, Sky will. And Tony Hayes goes, well, I'll live with that. So that was the kind of attitude I got. It's like, this is obviously a brilliant front cover. And it was a front cover that never happened. And then NME do it, and they don't even have the balls to put it on the front. They just have them sucking separate sticks of rock on the front, although they do have the double suck on the centre pages, but still bitter. Yeah, anyway.
Did you ram a big cheese on a fork into your editor's face?
Yeah. Smell my rock. you mother.
We were brought together by a drunken meeting at Reading Festival, and it was just, ah, oh, great idea. Let's tour together. I'll see you there, says Burgess. Both groups have got really strong followings, and both groups are just totally into music, man. When asked about whether the rumours about Ride's impending split are true, Gardner is diplomatic to the point of tedium. Now I know how Michael Jackson feels, he says. It was just a bit of a stressed out year for us all, really. Andy Bell didn't have a nervous breakdown or two as rumoured. He just had a bad joint. Meanwhile, Burgess is on legal instructions not to talk about Rob Collins, his keyboard player who was arrested before Christmas after his mate attempted an armed holdup at a supermarket in Staffordshire while he was sat in the car like Father Ted and Dougal when Tom nipped into the post office, so the rest of the interview isn't worth talking about, really.
I went away on a trip with Ride as well.
Oh, did you know?
Yeah, not long after this. This was to LA, and their tour manager in the States was the third Copeland brother. So you've got Stuart Copeland, you've got Miles Copeland, and you've got this other guy who was a Vietnam vet. And we went round his house to do a photo shoot, I think it was. And he got out, first of all, the biggest bag of weed I've seen in my life. It's like a fucking pillow. But then he said, I know, why don't we all do a bit of paintballing in the gardens? And he's up in the Hollywood Hills and there's all this fucking undergrowth. And I'm like a bit wary of this, but okay, okay. So, you know, we all get our guns and our pellets and off we go and hide in the bushes. And he comes fucking hunting us down. And he's obviously got some kind of proper PTSD rage stored up inside him. He's just, he's not fucking showing any mercy. He's just, because those pellets, if you've been hit by a paintball pellet at close range, it fucking hurts, man. We weren't wearing any padded gear. Like, oh my God, yeah. So that's my main memory of hanging around with riders being shot at by this deranged Rambo figure.
That's when you need your customised cheap on drugs motorbike jacket.
Exactly.
And your Clint Eastwood waistcoat.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. All of it. Yeah.
And Terry Staunton drops in on the Would I Lie to You hitmakers Charles and Ed Air and reveals that even they are falling foul of BBC censorship. The traffic lights blink on and off as Charles and Eddie strut along the sidewalk, recalling their early days in the Big Apple, writes Staunton. They remember the cool sounds their DJ friend Smash would spin down at the Soul Kitchen. They give each other a knowing smile and agree. Yeah, that shit was funky. Suddenly, a middle-aged man with an Oxbridge accent, wearing a set of headphones, yells above the melting pot hustle and bustle of the mean streets. Cut! This is not America. This is Elstree. This is an afternoon run-through on a BBC soundstage, and the man with the headphones has deemed that shit is not a particularly top-of-the-pops friendly word. The walking about on the streets of Elstree, was that Walford?
Oh, good question, yeah.
Single reviews. Sam Steele is in the chair this week, and her single of the week is 15 Minutes of Fame by Sheep on Drugs.
Hey.
The trademark SOD barrage of techno rock and acid-edged mayhem is still as spiky and wicked as Beelzebub's tail, and just as sexily alluring. Zig Zig Sputnik were never as devilishly clever or absurdly anti-stylish as Sheep on Drugs, which is why 15 Minutes of Fame might just be a conservative estimate. These wolves, and for the last time the name refers to you, not them, are going to worry the moral majority into a frenzy of fear.
Yeah, sadly that wasn't the case, but I fucking loved them. I remember the first time I saw them was supporting Daisy Chainsaw at Yulu.
Right.
And Duncan, the singer, had painted on hair with a sort of painted on centre parting, a bit like, I don't know, Frank Sidebottom meets Adolf Hitler, really. And after about two songs, he was sweating so much under the lights, and this must have been intentional, that it all just streaked down his face and looked really horrific. And
oh, like Rudy Giuliani. Yeah.
It was amazing. They were just, they were such a good band. But yeah, in hindsight, they were never going to trouble the charts or the moral majority, I don't think.
Dodgy have put out their fourth single, Water Under the Bridge, and still reckons it's going to finally put them over the top and into the charts. Dodgy have seemingly got it all. Sex god good looks, their own groovy Carnaby Street club, and they've finally stirred themselves from their ultra-cool existence to bring us water under the bridge. Armed with swirling post-psychedelic guitars and instantly forgettable melodies, Dodgy stride effortlessly into the abyss of bag air, so cruelly abandoned by the Stone Roses at the beginning of the last century. While A&M's men in suits pop the corks in celebration of the fact that Dodgy have finally come up with a pleasant poppet of a song after nearly a year, those poor sods at Geffen, home of the Stone Cold Roses, must be pulling their ponytails out in despair.
I can't really see a Stone Roses comparison. That's a bit of a weird way to review them, but okay.
Jamiroquai have pitched up with their second single, Too Young to Die, and still really, really reckons it, and him, and them. Jamiroquai. Got it? Good. Remember it, because the big voice and even bigger hats are unlikely to go away. Jay, the wearer of the woolly tea cozy, has one of the most powerful and impressive soul voices to slide across the dance spectrum in a long while, jumping full force onto the jazz-funk bandwagon, pioneered by the brand new Heavies and Galliano. Too Young is a singing up-tempo follow-up to last year's club hit, When You Gonna Learn. And with Jay's tendency to break into a scat at the first opportunity, is as catchy as a cold on the underground.
See, it all started so positively, but it ended with going to prison for storming the Capitol because Donald Trump told him to.
Yes. But it's a coat down for Looking Through Patient Eyes by PM Dawn, a bland rehash that is only going to excite adventurous Michael Jackson fans and Radio 4 listeners. Hysteria Unknown by Strangelove reveals that singer Patrick's screwed up childhood, his history of alcohol abuse, and his deep depressions are the bedrock from which his intensely personal songs are hewn. It is also this same depth of feeling that elevates Strangelove from simple shoegazing to spiritual soul searching. Elsewhere, Sidi Bou Said are called a girl group, not you understand that gender is a yardstick by which to measure anything, during Steele's review of Twilight Eyes. Die Cheerleader's Saturation EP is proof positive that girls can be as bold and big on guitars as any boy rockers, and the dramatic flutes and somber strings of Baron de Forlong's Saint Spectre Morse theme will allow Morse's memory to live on. Dig it, kid!
I had a mate who was obsessed with Die Cheerleader and used to go to all their gigs, but he thought they were German and they were called Die Cheerleader. Seriously.
In the album review section this week, Pride of Place is actually a twofer, featuring Yeah, 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 Yeah by Bikini Kill on one side and Our Troubled Youth by Huggy Bear on the other. This is the first fruits from the so-called Riot Girl movement, ripe for plucking by some adventurous major label subsidiary, says Edwin Pouncey. The Riot Girl tag has been lazily looped around Bikini Kill's neck in a vague attempt to explain what they do, but it's confusing and deceptive. Bikini Kill are like some hot rod engine that's been stripped down to the basics and filled with sonic true punk. The only really shocking thing about Huggy Bear is how fast they've learned to make records that sound both crudely troubled and flash at the same time. Huggy Bear's side is the most immediate, the one you keep coming back for. But the real way to play this record is with your eyes closed. Just slam it on the turntable, drop that needle, and jump back at the surprise that leaps out of the speakers. But it's a coat down for practically everything else this week. Frank Black has finally crawled out from under the wreckage of the Pixies to put out his debut solo LP, Frank Black, but Deli for Deli dismisses it as an insubstantial corporate take on indie rock. Deacon Blue have failed to achieve the stadium-filling status for which they were once tipped, and they must have cost Columbia a small fortune. So perhaps they were frog-marched into a record company office and told by an AR man to get trendy. Why else have they paid creditor cost producers Paul Oakenfold and Steve Osborne to make them sound like the Happy Mondays? Asked John Harris in his review of Whatever You Say, Say Nothing. It's empty opportunism. Why has terminally irritating frontman Ricky Ross decided to start wearing stupid shades and ill-fitting rock star togs that make him look like someone in a Bono look-alike parade? Bollocks on all counts, really. This is lucky to scrape a 3 out of 10. Oh, it's a bad time for the 80s bands, isn't it? Are you going to go my way? Asked Lenny Kravitz on the title track of his third album. Fuck off, am I? Replies Stephen Dalton, who calls it the sound of Kravitz shagging an elegantly dressed corpse. He's constructed an entire career from second-hand Leninism, third-hand Hendrixism, and stinking tenth-hand hippieism. Cutting his cloth from the Emperor's old clothes, he stitched together this theme park boutique of trouser rock. Oh, sorry, collared rock, if you will. Fashionably crumpled, worn in the right places, but utterly empty. True Kravitz devotees, airhead-style vultures, Notting Hill hippies and music-biz twats will keep the faith because he still provides them with a solid get-out clause for their reactionary tastes, reducing the era they blindly idolise to a safe retro fashion spread draped in hollow peace and love poses. It was easy to hate Wendy James, champion of Barbie feminism, when she fronted corporate terrorist Transvision Vamp. It was easy to dismiss her as the gherkin in the great hamburger of art. She didn't like clothes, but she liked screaming about the revolution. She was a complete prat. But Wendy wrote to Santa, aka Elvis Costello, in the summer of 1991, and he wrote her an LP. Simple, eh? And now everyone will say that there's far more to her than meets the eye. That she has things to say. Right, Sean Patton of Wendy James's debut solo LP, Now Ain't the Time for Your Tears. Ultimately, James has made an LP which is fairly proficient, but more importantly, an LP which is dull. It's all about Wendy and her world, which is not enough for 10 songs. Now Ain't the Time proves one thing beyond doubt. Elvis Costello has a sense of humour, for that is the only excuse one can make for this sniffle of an album. In the gig guide, well, David could have seen Soho at the Brixton Fridge, cheered on his fellow MM hack Chris Roberts fronting Catwalk at the Borderline.
I was there.
Terminal Cheesecake at the Islington Powerhouse, Radiohead at the Underworld, Eric Clapton at the Albert Hall, Daisy Chainsaw at Camden Palace.
I was there too.
And Dumpy's Rusty Nuts at the Woolwich Tram Shed, but probably didn't. Taylor could have seen the Hollies at Wolverhampton Grand Theatre, the Steve Gibbons Band again at Birmingham Breedon Bar, Panic Beach at Dudley JB's, or the Uncontrollable Noise Explosion at the Mitre in Stourbridge, all dependent on him recovering from Nigel Kennedy's two-night stint at Birmingham Ronnie Scott's. Ooh. Sarah could have seen Radiohead at Leeds Duchess of York, Rudimentary Peni also at the Duchess of York, Radical Dance Faction at Sheffield Hallamshire Hotel, Senseless Things at Sheffield Uni, or join the Proto Weller Dads for the Mod Fathers show at the Leeds Town and Country Club. Al could have knocked back the Bile Bear at the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow at Nottingham Trent Poly, Alice in Chains at Rock City, and wound up the week checking out spare parts at Loughborough's The Swan in the Rushers. Neil could have seen Sultans of Ping at Cov Uni, Wall of Sleep at Coventry General Wolf, although probably didn't because the lead singer threatened to glass him once, yeah. And absolutely fuck all else. While Simon could have seen the Indigo Girls at Bristol Fleece and Firkin, Climax Blues Band at Newport King's Hotel, Senseless Things at Bristol Uni, or Tamsin Archer at Cardiff St David's Hall.
I like how you've expanded the radius of my local patch to include Bristol, because that's what it was fucking like. Nothing happens in Wales. Yeah.
In the letters page, well, Sean Pattenden has been entrusted with angst this week, and the main topic of conversation is a response to a letter a fortnight ago from Terence T. Simmons from Birmingham, who trotted out the line about the white working class being edged out by ethnic minorities and the gays.
Fucking hell.
I'm working class, left school at 16, went into manual work. I am now unemployed, but in no way do I blame people of different ethnic origins or have a different sexuality than me for my hard life in the real world, writes Working Class and Proud from Farnborough. The people who are to blame for the shit we live in are the politicians and ruling class who promote racism and homophobia to divide and rule us. These dickheads need bigoted people like Simmons to keep them in power. So Simmons, just fuck off! Middle-class anti-fascist from Stockport, however, has a somewhat different point of view. Get real, Terence Simmons, you working-class dickhead. Why does the enemy continue to follow the sad old oi, Gary Bushell, pro-working-class line? Fact! The working class is the most reactionary socio-economic group in Europe. Real radical social change has always been inspired by the radical intelligentsia. And if you're talking music, most of the decent radical songwriters of the last 15 years went to public school. Shane McGowan, Joe Strummer, Brett Anderson.
He didn't.
Chris out of the Redskins, to name but a few, Simon.
Brett didn't go to public school. No, that's no, a really weird thing to say.
He looks like he did, though, and that's the main thing.
Christ.
If you go around slapping your own arse, mate, people are going to assume that you went there.
For fuck's sake.
When we fight Nazis on the streets, we're fighting the working class. Yes, you, Terence, you thick homophobe. When we argue against stool brains in pubs, we're arguing with the working class. Let's have an intelligence qualification for the vote. Say, 3 A-levels and at least one suede single. Then the mass of sun-reading, bigoted, brain-dead sheep who have kept the Tories in power for the last 13 years wouldn't be able to fester drunkenly over the destruction of everything decent and worthwhile in this country. Terence, I went to public school on a scholarship, no fees, and I'm fucking proud of it. Most of my friends and their parents are professionals. It's called intelligence, you sad reactionary oik. And I live in the real world as much as you do, matey. A big black pair of gay Doc Martens are going pro-bashing in Birmingham soon.
Fucking hell. Everybody in this debate seems just lovely, don't they?
I know. What about the music, man?
I do want to know where I can buy a big black pair of gay Dr. Martens, though.
Yeah.
Please, yeah.
Music-wise, as with the rest of this issue, Huggy Bear feature heavily. Let me set the scene, writes Neil from Leeds. Here I am, sitting all on my lonesome on Friday night. Until tonight I was a fairly average, normal, everyday kind of guy. Tonight things changed. I watched The Word. I saw the Huggy Revolution. Before now, I'd heard of Huggy Bear, not knowing what they sounded like, but tonight they definitely meant something and started something special. And when they started shouting about the really shitty sexist piece about the two American bimbos, the Barbie twins, it really hit me. For once, I agreed with The Word's crowd, be they members of Huggy Bear or whatever, be with us or against us, it's up to you. God, do you remember that bit?
No.
They'd just done a piece about the Barbie twins, and then Huggy Bear started shouting at Terry Christian, and he tried to calm it down, and Henry Rollins just sat there not knowing what the fuck was going on, really.
My main memory of Huggy Bear on The Word is that it was reported on by members of Melody Maker who'd gone along as sort of cheerleaders for the whole Riot Girl thing.
Right Girl?
Yeah, Right Girl.
Oh, no, that's a bit too Dexys.
It's a bit too Roy Orbison. Girl. Yeah.
Yes.
the Riot G contingent at Melody Maker America were furious that the Channel 4 staff had made them take their coats off, that they couldn't go in the studio audience with their coats on.
Oh.
This was their big rallying cry. They made us take off our coat, you know, as if that was the worst thing that ever happens.
But
to
they
anyone.
Felt the benefit afterwards.
They felt the benefit, exactly. Channel 4 were just looking out for them, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Gavin from Haywards Heath, however, believes that Huggy Bear's ticket pricing structure is just another form of sexism. Whilst visiting a record emporium in Brighton, I noticed a flyer for the Huggy Bear gig at the Brighton Richmond. I quickly looked to see how much the tickets were, and much to my surprise, I noted that for unemployed and students, this much-hyped band could be seen for a mere £3. Then I noticed that this reduction included girls! 2 exclamation marks. In other words, if you're not a student, unemployed or female, you have to pay 50p more to get in. Just what in the hell are Huggy Bear trying to achieve with this action? Before you dismiss me as a chauvinist pig, I am very much in favour of equal rights. But to openly distinguish between the sexes in this way amounts to blatant sexism in the extreme. If Huggy Bear want to change people's attitudes to women's rights in society, then they are not going to do it by suppressing men's.
It's interesting, isn't it, that there is some kind of horseshoe effect at play in terms of the interaction between sexism and pricing at music events. Because on the one hand, you've got those sleazy nightclubs that, you know, let women in for free.
Yes.
And then right the other side of the horseshoe, you've got Huggy Bear, who are the opposite of that, but are also letting women in really cheap.
Maybe Huggy Bear should have offered free entry to all men who turned up to the venue in really tight shorts and give them a complimentary glass of fizz. Gavin of Leicester was very excited to see his hometown featuring in the pages of the NME for the first time since the days of Show Waddy Waddy, thanks to a recent interview with Corner Shop. The whole Corner Shop explosion is so important to not only Leicester, but Britain. The challenging of society's stereotypes and music's traditionalism is what this shithole of a country needs. The very fact that they can't play their instruments only adds to the excitement. Corner Shop will, over a period of time, develop into an awesomely powerful band, and disbelievers will repent. Bands like them and, fucking hell, Huggy Bear again will, in years to come, be cited as a major influence upon the music and attitudes of their time. The media attention is very much justified, as the threat of right-wing activism is more rife than ever before, and those who make a formal stand against fascists and general ignorance deserve praise. Ignorance is Britain's downfall. 14 years of conservative rule. Why can't people wake up? No, different times, everyone.
I agree with one sentiment in that letter, which is the very fact that they can't play their instruments only adds to the excitement. Because I remember at Melody Maker, some of the people who really disparaged Riot Girl saying, well, the problem with these bands like Huggy Bear is they can't play their instruments.
No.
As if, you know, that was it. That was just the end. You know, nothing further need be said.
Mm.
And, you know, the same with Corner Shop. The fact is, those bands could play their instruments enough to make that record. And if you find that record exciting, then it doesn't need any more technique than that. It doesn't need somebody that's able to play some kind of stupid fucking twiddly guitar solo. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, what do you want them to do? Use samplers and that?
Right, yeah.
The other news story that has agitated the readership is Suede appearing at the Brit Awards, even though they weren't nominated for anything. It is somewhat refreshing to witness a band who refuse to put principles before selling their souls for fame and fortune. This is no doubt why the NME have so readily embraced Suede to its heaving bosom, says Craig from Ulverston. But it was rather worrying to watch the said foursome perform Animal Night Rate. Yes, that's what he wrote. Animal Night Rate at the Brit Awards. I can't help believing that if Mr. Anderson and colleagues told the Brits organisers that if they wanted the band on the show so badly, they should have voted for them originally. Better, is it not, to be loved truly by one person than handicapped by a couple of dozen you hate? No respect for their vacuous nominations indeed. Carl Essendall from London, who appears to be a regular contributor to Angst of late, is less florid. Dear WEA, withering establishment artists, think about it, kids, and Brits chairman Rob Dickens, why are you inciting your own murder? I would like to nail your testicles to your bedroom ceiling and test kitchen knives on your stupid faces. Perhaps when a few pints of blood have congealed on the carpet, you'll stop spewing smug bullshit. Out of 48 nominations, how dare you not include Suede? How dare you kick us in the teeth with your sterile, average nominations? Enjoy your nightmares, spit out your artist's arse hairs, and change your underwear.
Somebody's been listening to the first Wu-Tang Clan album, haven't they? I fucking sew your asshole closed and keep feeding you and feeding you.
And Carl Rushbridge and Nichols of Hailsham write to inform us that the letters Brett Anderson of Suede can be rearranged to spell Sad Nose of Utter Bender. I just thought you might like to know that. 55 pages, 70p, I never knew there was so much fucking Huggy Bear in it. So, what else was on telly this day? Well, BBC One kicks off at 6am with Business Breakfast, followed by 2 and a bit hours of BBC Breakfast News. After Kilroy starts an argument, it's a quarter of an hour of Ross King doing some sort of quiz. Then it's Play Days and Good Morning with Anne and Nick. Pebble Mill, no longer at 1 but at 1:15 noon, is next, followed by regional news in your area, the news, a repeat of yesterday's Neighbours, and the quiz show First Letter First, the short-lived wordy game show hosted by Don McLean. No, not that one. After the 1981 TV movie Isabel's Choice, about a secretary who has to choose between marrying her retiring boss or continuing her career with the new one, it's Rupert, Melvin and Maureen's Musicograms, Jack and Aura, The New Yogi Bear Show, The Hotel for Puppets series Dizzy Heights, News Round and Blue Peter. Then it's Neighbours, the 6 o'clock news and regional news in your area. BBC Two commences at 6:45am with a triple bill of Open University, then dips into BBC One's feed of breakfast news for a quarter of an hour, and then it's 45 minutes of yesterday's red-hot thrill ride at the Houses of Parliament in Westminster. At 9am, daytime on 2 kicks in with Schools Programmes, Thunderbirds, More Schools Programmes, The Adventures of Spot, Brum, Dilly the Dinosaur and More Schools Programmes. Then it's You and Me, then the Welfare Rights magazine show Advice Shop, the news, the small business show I Could Do That, the documentary Some of Our Airmen Are No Longer Missing, about the work of the Air Force Recovery Unit and how they recover bodies of pilots lost during World War II. Then it's From the Edge, the magazine show for the disabled. Food and Drink makes Rabbit with Prunes, and they're an hour into Kenny Rogers as the Gambler, the 1980 TV film which stars Kenny Rogers as the Gambler. ITV is a 24-hour concern now, so we'll begin at 6am with 3.5 hours of GMTV, followed by the British version of Jeopardy. Then it's regional news in your area, the time, the place, this morning, and Riddlers on the Road. After the news and regional news in your area, it's Home and Away, a country practice, the third quarterfinal of the Wicks British Snooker Open in Derby, more news and regional news in your area, Blockbusters, Where's Wally, Mike and Angelo, Tiny Toons Adventures, a repeat of this afternoon's Home and Away, the news at 5:40, regional news in your area, and they've just started Emmerdale. Channel 4 drops in on Sesame Street at 10 to 6, then it's Dennis, America's piss-poor attempt to rip off Dennis the Menace that can fuck right off. After 2 hours of The Big Breakfast, it's a game show, You Bet Your Life. Then it's 2.5 hours of schools programmes that Simon already knew about due to his computer. After the Parliament programme, Sesame Street and the Australian kids show lift off, it's the 1938 British comedy film Sailing Along. Then some artists or as a goz at Hans Memling's St John altarpiece in Masterworks, followed by Food File and Countdown. Spike Lee and Malcolm X's wife and daughter are the guests on the Oprah Winfrey Show because the film debuts tomorrow in the UK. Then it's the Magic Roundabout, followed by the Word Access or Areas. And then Tony Daly of Aston Villa batters a child 5-0 at Stryker on the SNES in Games Master. And they've just started Channel 4 News. Me dears, what is jumping out from you from that schedule?
Malcolm X getting followed by the Magic Roundabout. That is a beautiful juxtaposition.
Yes. Yes.
Also, Kenny Rogers, the gambler. They should have made a follow-up film about islands in the stream in which he's just an island, just sort of sits there.
Yeah.
That's it. Nothing happens.
Or Kenny Rogers bombing about in a car and jumping the lights, called Kenny Rogers as the Amber Gambler.
Oh, right, right.
Well, me dears, I do believe that a table of sorts has been laid and we're going to tuck into a feast of 1993 in the next episode of Chart Music. So all that remains for me to say is thank you, Sarah B.
In a bit.
God bless you, Simon Price.
See you later.
My name's Al Needham. Stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.